Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM.
Do you write music too?
Honey, I live music. Morning, noon, a whole night. Everything else is just icing on the cake, you dig?
I do.
In my native village in Johannesburg, there is a song that we always sing when a young girl gets married. It's called the click song by the English because they cannot say "Ongotwane." Igqirha lendlela ngongotwane.
And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. We're here until 9 o'clock. Excuse the distraction here, but I have to say this for the first time in a long time, the guest is actually dancing. My guest tonight is Lisa Dwan, actress, and I'm so delighted you're here, Lisa.
It's a privilege
to be here.
You're
a busy, busy woman, and you're in town because you've a play opening on Thursday night.
That's right.
And what is it? What is this play?
Well, it's called Pale Sister, and it's a retelling of the Antigone myth, written from the point of view of Ismene, her sister, and it was written especially for me by Colm Toibean. And it's a one-woman play, and it's at the Gate.
Can't go wrong.
One hopes. Famous last word.
We'll talk about all that as the night goes on. But anyway, that's a great reason that you're back in town and we can do this. And thanks for sparing the time. So we're here until 9 o'clock. Lisa Dwan is with me. Lisa is an actress very much associated with the work of Samuel Beckett, but also on your screens these days. I have to check because I will call it Toy Boy. it's Top Boy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a Netflix. Ronan Bennett wrote this,
didn't
he?
That's right, yeah. So funny, I was just thinking, I came across Ronan's work 20-something years ago here.
Yeah.
The Catastrophist, yeah. Extraordinary novel if anyone gets a chance to read it. And I was crossing campus when I got a phone call out of the blue from Rowan and telling me that he'd written me this role, and it was an Irish drug dealer, and the first person he thought of was me. But would I consider going for it? And so I had to audition for it several times. Netflix didn't know me from Adam, and I did, and I got the role, and I've just shot 10 episodes in London. It's inner city, drugs, gang, crime, family, gentrification.
What difference does it make to you as a working actor now to be on something like a Netflix series like that? Because, you know, you do all this Beckett stuff and you're known for that. But the very nature of that, it's in the theatre. You're not in people's faces every night of the week on the television. And then suddenly you are. Does that change things?
Well, it started off in telly. I mean, the reason why I had to, or felt I had to leave Ireland, was I was considered just a TV actress. I was having huge difficulty getting seen or considered as a stage actor. I mean, people love their boxes, and I keep finding myself in new boxes that I have to try and get out of. But the propensity to box me doesn't change.
I thought you had climbed into your preferred box at this point and doing the Beckett thing.
No, I just like to keep people on their toes. Only what was it, 6 months ago, someone said, oh, you do other theatre. Mm-hmm. Oh, we thought that you were just a performance artist.
Yeah.
And then I'm doing this and none of my cast members know who Beckett is. And that's kind of nice. Or, that's not to say that they don't know who he is, but he's not on their day-to-day register. Well, maybe saved. In the way that...
Before we play your next choice of music, yeah. You started out as a ballet in ballet. That was really your thing, wasn't it, early
yeah,
on?
Yeah. I mean, the reason why I chose the Miriam Makeba... is that, you know, I think we have certainly I have fallen into this trap occasionally. Maybe it's an Irish thing that we harbour or remember our kind of negative aspects of our childhood, like a competitive sport. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in a time of McGahern and Angela's Ashes. I remember Dad throwing down that book saying, geez, it's where no one ever suffered. And I forget that there were moments that were extraordinarily happy, yeah. And that despite our and my propensity for Black Dog, that there's an extraordinary propensity for joy. And
this was an Athlone.
And we all would get up and dance to Miriam Makeba. Mm. And both my brother and my sister went to United World College. And so the house was always filled with versions of Nokus Ukulele and all the music that was brought back from their sort of international experiences. David was in Vancouver Island and Renata, my sister, was in Montezuma. And they would just bring back all of this kind of... Mm. excitement and culture back to our house, and our house was always kind of filled with music.
And so, were you sent to ballet or did you volunteer for that?
Well, I can't even remember. I you know, there was this extraordinary lady in Athlone called Maura Sloan who set up a ballet school in the Jolly Marner, and it was a nightclub. By day gave way to shoals of blue leotards who were feeding a parent's promise of a would-be Giselle, delivering a sort of deportment of sorts to an Athlone home, and in my case, my desire to be on stage. I grew up under this kind of spell of what my father was like when he was on stage. Oh, your father was a great comedian and you must be great on stage. And maybe that was, maybe stage was the language of love in our house. I don't know. But from as early as I can remember, that's all I wanted to be. I remember someone coming around to our school asking us all, what did we want to be when we grew up? And I couldn't believe that people would muffle their own expectations by choosing pedestrian kind of jobs, which are probably fine. I was like, well, either astronaut or actor. You know, it seemed utterly plausible in Athlone. But this woman, you know, I remember I must have been about 3 or 4 and she decided to put on Coppelia, this ballet. And I mean, she was extraordinary. She'd watched the videos of the Royal Ballet where the actual choreography of Petipa was used, and she would take it down and annotate it and use that exact choreography among our dancers. Wow. And try and teach us these moves.
You're very lucky, weren't you? You know, you were very lucky.
I was so lucky that these women would just...
But that there was someone like that.
You know, that we would attempt to glissade through these chewing gummed, beer-stained floors, holding poise through the heady mix of fags and porter wafting in from next door, but dancing the actual choreography from the Royal Ballet. I felt that these women were extraordinary. And Mrs. Sloan, I'll never forget, taking Coppelia onto the Dean Crow stage in Athlone, and every parent was sewing costumes, and there was a whole kind of infrastructure built around this vision of hers.
Yeah.
And my sister was playing France, and I remember her daughter was playing Swanhilda. And I would sit at the side of the stage at night and be swept up by this extraordinary narrative. And in a way, Coppelia's narrative, this creation of an inventor, of a doll maker, has helped me understand Beckett. Ballet was my first reference point and gave me the sort of psychological freedom to unlock some of the more tricky aspects of Beckett, in the sense that my imagination could roam from playing rats to dolls to puppets to the Willys group, a room, you know, a group of supernatural women who would glide across these waters and dance angry men to death.
Dear God.
But I was, when I was 12 years of age.
And well, here, this is the bit that seems, you know, it's okay. This is brilliant. You're on Athlone, and this is a wonderful woman, this teacher.
Exactly.
And it's great. But then you're dancing with Nureyev by the time you're 12.
It's hilarious, yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, you know, it was a publicity stunt. The Cleveland San Jose Ballet Company were working with Rudolf Nureyev in Coppelia. He was playing Dr. Coppelius. So he wasn't doing massive 6-foot leaps for freedom in the air. He was playing a character role. And it was 2 years before he died. So I would imagine he would have been quite sick. And they came to Dublin and they auditioned for a dancer to dance with him. So members of our enthusiastic ballet group in Athlone were thrown into the car. I was promised a McDonald's, and that's why I was going. I don't know about anyone else. I didn't even know who Nureyev was. And I got chosen for the role. And my mom said, well, she can't do it because I have to take them back to Athlone and rehearsal starts tomorrow. And some kindly woman said, we'll take her. And so mom took everyone back to Athlone in the car. And I stayed with strangers that night and met Nureyev the next day. And so I danced for a week on stage with him in the wings, and we'd sit at the side, and I would look at this man entering the theatre every night with a green beret and this long green leather trench coat and this gorgeous scar over his lip. I thought he was the sexiest, most charismatic man I'd ever come across. And I would watch him shouting at the American dancers for throwing their hips out of alignment and not keeping the integrity of form in favor of spectacle. And I'll never forget, it almost seemed to hurt him when they would kind of throw their bodies around with such kind of vigor, with that kind of integrity. And I'll never forget it. And it was, you know, this ballet was so much part of my life and my
imagination.
You've
chosen some music from Coppelia, I see. So I'm not sure what exactly we're going to play, but here it comes. Music there from Coppelia, and the choice of Lisa Dwan, who danced Coppelia not only as a child in Athlone, but then later as a 12-year-old with Nureyev. It's a mad story, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is.
No, it is. There's no guessing, there's no guessing about it. But all roads seem to lead back to Beckett for you, because while that was playing, you were thinking about Beckett.
Yeah, I mean, this ballet, and particularly that moment in the ballet where your heart opens up to this inventor who's in love with his invention. And it, like so many of the ballets are like that. Petrushka, this puppet, who in the final act was seen as a sort of high point in ballet, where he rails against his maker and his life. And then you don't know, well, who is real and who isn't? Is the creator or is it the puppet has more life here? And Beckett went to see Petrushka, Mani the one-act plays of the Ballet Russe, and it had a profound effect on him that made its way into the novel he was writing at the time, Buttoned Up and Left to Dance. He was like Petrushka in his box. And I've always felt that ballet really found me the keys to open up Beckett's work, particularly his later roles and his later female roles, when Footfalls, whether you wonder, is she there are not there. His mother, the voice with real agency who's tormenting May on stage, or is May, you know, a figure of mother's imagination? And I've always enjoyed the metaphysical aspect of Beckett, to be able to transcend my own body and particularly the politics around my own body. And most of his creatures, they're creatures, they're not characters. They're slices of life, they're slices of the whole. And in order for me to inhabit that wholly and fully, you have to let your imagination take you there. And I think my imagination was nourished from a very young age as a dancer.
See, I'd love to know how you get to this point from being a kid in Athlone, right? Nothing wrong with Athlone, a kid anywhere in Ireland, you know. And you mentioned a couple of things earlier on that suggest to me that maybe the house was a bit, the family life was a bit sort of rarefied. You said your dad was a comedian, but was he a comedian, an actual comedian, or just a funny guy? And you also mentioned, you know, ponies, which suggests that you're aristocracy, which you're not.
And I mean, you really need to have a look at these ponies.
and that your siblings were travelling to far-flung places, you know, and coming back with strange music.
Well, the truth is, there wasn't a lot of money. My father was made redundant when I was about 8, and Mam was
put
back.
What did he do,
back.
By the way?
He took a job up with Heineken and distributed that initially with just a trailer and 2 kegs that built up to a whole distribution centre. But he did it himself, and he'd come home from that and tear off the shirt and then do the garden or fix the lawn more. And he was great with his hands, and he was a real can-do guy. And I remember looking out the back window at his bare chest as he was trying to level the garden, and just the effort and the strain. And I'll never forget that. And I've inherited that work ethic, and I admire it in other people. In terms of our notions of ourselves, yes, they did. And I think it was a very deliberate move, you know, and I think it was a move of many Irish families, actually. You know, Ireland came out of a civil war, and the last thing we wanted was our vision to be narrowed back into nationalism, you know. And I think my parents were very adamant that they wanted to expand our vision of ourselves and what we could possibly be by opening up the world to us. Or our house was called Shalom, and I don't know why we had Yentl on all the time, but there were Spanish dancers and there was talk of our Italian blood.
I don't want to rain on your parade, there were a lot of bungalows called Shalom around the country. There seemed to be quite a few. Shalom must have been the inn name.
Probably that's all it was. But houses. I do feel that they worked hard at expanding our
and
idea.
And
Europe played a very big deal in that.
And would you have considered it, looking back, a kind of an arty house or a bohemian house? Or, you know, what you've talked about so far is kind of like business and fairly conservative kind of approach to life, you know?
I wouldn't say either of my parents are big readers, so I don't know how they managed to spawn 4 academics. I don't know how that was possible. Renata, my eldest sister, broke the mold and she got a scholarship to United World College. Then she went to Oxford. She now has a very senior position in the UN. My brother's a professor in Oxford. Karina's a professor in Harvard.
And you're on the television.
And I'm on the television.
You're a disgrace to the family, really. You're black sheep.
I'm a drug dealer on television.
The black sheep. What about acting then? Do you remember when's the first time you acted? I'm not talking about ballet, but...
I'll tell you exactly when it was. I was in high infants, I think I must have been. Is that when you're 7, just before you make your Holy Communion, or maybe a little bit before that? And Mrs. O'Connor, another teacher, sent for me. You know, the muncher would send for, get a child to come in and send for Miss Dwan. So I was brought into a gym where she was instructing some kids on stage. And she said, "Now, Lisa, now that you're, could you walk across the stage like you're a duck?" I said, "What?" And she, "You're Liam Dwan's daughter, aren't you?" And I went, "Yeah, I am. Could you please just walk and show these students how to walk like a duck?" And so I didn't know what I was being asked to do, but she was kind of terrifying. So I did my best effort to walk across the stage like a duck. And she went, "Thank you. Yes, it wasn't from the ground she licked it. Off you go."
Wow.
So,
I wish this was television now, because I would ask you to demonstrate the duck walk. Your next musical choice is the Pixies. Why the Pixies?
I was a bit bullied in school, maybe because of my duck walking, or maybe because I was a bit odd, and maybe because I danced with Nuri Avera, who knows? I guess it did mark you out from the crowd. But or maybe I'm just annoying. But either way, it was a bit tough, and I was moving to another school. And I was heading out the door, like a good first year, with my skirt basically down to my heels and some kind of cheesy keyring dangling from it and my shirt buttoned up and looking all prim. And my brother said, "Where are you going?" And I went, "I'm going to school." And he said, "Do you want another fucking year like you've had?" And he said, "Come here to me." And he grabbed my school bag and ripped it up and wrote, "I am a nihilist," and wrote the Pixies, and got Tipex. And he was like, "Now you listen to the Pixies, and this is Sonic Youth, and this is therapy." And then he put on a leather cap on me, and "Don't just put one earring in." And he was like, "Right, you're off. Roll up that feckin' skirt." And for like a whole, I'd say 6 months, until they really discovered what was underneath, I was kind of cool. And it was thanks to the Pixies. Stop.
Where is my mind? Pixies, the choice of Lisa Dewan, who's with me in the studio tonight. Lisa's play, Pale Sister, written by Colin Tobin, opens on Thursday night at the Gate Theatre. Lisa's in here tonight picking all the tunes. She'll be rehearsing, but she's here picking all the tunes. And it's going well. So we've learned so much so far about your duck walking abilities and all the rest of it. When did you maybe have a notion that acting could possibly be a career path? Something you might do?
Oh, not until way later. Mm. At this point, people were sitting up listening to looking at my dance, and I was offered a scholarship to a ballet school in England at 14, and I took it. For me, it was a chance to get out of Ireland and an opportunity to dance every day, whereas in the Jolly Mariner with Maura Sloan, it was maybe most twice a week. And I remember it was the Royal Ballet exams, and this woman, Dorothy Stevens, came over from England, and she asked me to stay back after the exam, and I thought, like I usually was, that I was in trouble. And because I hadn't been practicing and I was copying the other girls. She asked me if I'd be interested in taking this seriously, and I was offered a scholarship. And
to where?
It's in Halifax, just between Halifax and Leeds, a place called Lightcliff.
But even at 14, I mean, I can imagine 17, 18 you want to get away, but at 14 you wanted to get away? You wanted to leave Ireland at 14?
Oh, yeah.
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 And were you getting bullied at school? And was it because you were on the telly and whatnot?
No, I think, look, I used to look out that window across the fields and just wonder what was on the other side of that. I don't know what it was. My parents love Athlone. They're very happy there. A lot of my really close friends in Athlone were very happy. I guess I was born with this kind of the princess and the pea metaphor. I don't know. I wasn't happy. I wanted to get out. You know, I was an odd little kid, you know, who memorized poetry for fun, who had all these notions in her head, who lived, like my school report says, Lisa lives in a fantasy world. So I didn't even know what being a dancer would look like or what it would be. For me, it was a ticket, and I was just so excited about the potential of a whole new landscape and leaving Ireland and going beyond that and being able to dance every day. And I knew I didn't fit in. So instead of having 8 more years of it constantly rammed into you how much you didn't fit in, isn't it better to just transcend that and leave and go where it's warm? And don't get me wrong, there were elements of Ireland that I still adore. And at that time, it was a very vibrant time in Ireland musically as well. You know, there was the Stunning and the Hothouse Flowers, and there was, you know, this extraordinary band, The Pale, who I
see what you're doing now.
I'm doing what Paul Muldoon does.
Yeah, you're producing the show from the stage. Oh God, listen, I know when I'm beat. Here it comes.
Tonight the moon is a desk lamp, the world is a page. Wardrobe bulging with bones and bills.
I haven't heard that in years. The Pale and Butterfly, the choice of Lisa Dwan, who's with me in studio. Now, you tried to get me away from the ballet there a moment ago, talking about it. But it seems to me really strange that, according to you, it was sort of so simple. And yet, when you know the way you got the scholarship and so on, and yet when you see anything to do with ballet dancers on television and so on, they have to train and work like boxers. Like, they're so physical, so tough. And it doesn't look like anything that comes easily to anybody. And maybe, was this just based on a natural gift that they then wanted to develop? Or could you just do it?
I remember the ballet teacher in the way that they could be so cruel. They weren't the things that I had difficulty with. I mean, I had other difficulties, but my physical ability and my stamina were never a problem.
Mm.
And I remember this teacher humiliating another girl by saying, well, she can do it. And if she can do it, how come you can't do it? And that kind of punishment, that kind of brutal treatment that we all used to receive. Now, my issues have always been kind of psychological in handling situations, I think. My physical ability to deliver things, thank God, has never been an issue. And we were dancing 10 hours a day, every day. But for me, it was just everything that was new just felt like a breath of fresh air. You know, there was this choreographer there called Josie Carrick. She's since died. And this goes back a little bit to Maura Sloan. She wouldn't speak in her dance class. And it was very serious. And I had never been exposed to anything other than ballet. So I didn't do modern or contemporary. And all of a sudden, I'm learning all about Martha Graham and Cunningham and different ways of using my body and where the integrity in a body lay. And this woman never spoke. She felt that dance was a complete language. And so you would go into her class and she always had a cigarette dangling out of her mouth. And I remember she had the most gorgeous nose, this kind of Roman nose that in anywhere outside of a dance studio might seem unattractive, but it gave her this extraordinary poise in a room like that. And the only time she would break the silence is to say, keep the kettle boiling. And she would, in that moment, create from the ether a dance, a piece of choreography that was just mind-blowing and stunning and beautiful. And in that moment created, by the end of the class, we'd all be dancing it, and then it would fall away. And that was it. And no one would remember, and that was that. And then she died. And if she only knew how much I think about her and those creations. And I remember she created a beautiful piece that I remember a Portuguese dancer, part of our gang, this amazing girl who introduced me to Gabriel Garcia Marquez. All I remember is how grateful I am to all these people introduced me to all these extraordinary things. And one of them was Silvio Rodriguez. And Josie created the most beautiful dance. And even though we were all dancing it, I just remember how stunning Sandra's performance was. And these are just only alive in the stubborn vestiges of my memory. And yet they're so important, and they're my guides often when I'm out there on my own on stage under the lights.
Now, while all this ballet clearly, clearly stood to you in lots of ways as an actor and in other ways, I'm just curious, and if it's problematic, don't go into it, but why did you not follow it through further?
So I guess my body was developing and I was dancing 10 hours a day, every day, and maybe nutrition wasn't at a high point, who knows, but the cartilage was wearing away and I was in a lot of pain. And then I got chosen to dance again, another, just one of those accidents that happen. I go to an audition, I got it, to dance with the London Lewis Ballet Company, and I was dancing with them on tour at the time. And I remember my first role with them was the Duchess in Sleeping Beauty. And all of a sudden I'm on the bench and my physiotherapist at the time was the Leeds United physiotherapist, Alan Sutton. And he told me that I had no cartilage in either knee and that a decision would have to be made. And so there was a conversation with many of the team and it was decided that I wouldn't be able to take my career any further.
Wow.
And I lost, it was like losing my tongue for a while. And I rocked up in Galway because I couldn't move home. I lived for a little bit in Germany. I ended up living in Freiburg in Germany, working in a Bosnian refugee camp. And then I travelled through, just in the evenings, I looked after a lovely little Down syndrome boy during the day called Jens. And I ended up travelling through Holland for a bit and then eventually no money and I had to return home. And I thought I better join my siblings and try and finish school and go the normal path again. But I really struggled with that transition. And I fell into one of my ferocious episodes of depression. And I was totally lost. And then someone said to me, walking down Quay Street one day, "Do you know, you'd be a very good actor." And suggested that I audition for Galway Youth Theatre. And I did, and I got it. And then I was offered the part of Jack Wheeson, As You Like It. And an agent came and spotted me and sent me for 3 auditions in Dublin, and I got all 3, and next thing I'm an actor.
Tell you, now that ballet story is tough, and you know, unfortunately, it's not an uncommon story
for
lots of people. And I was going to ask you, how do you feel about it now?
Oh, I'm so grateful.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, if only I had the gift of hindsight, I wouldn't have gone to those places of despair. But you know, again, like anything, even any sort of travel will expand you, and even if it's traveling to the place of despair, you learn from that. And I think your propensity for humanity grows. And look, I remember that time in ballet school with such fondness. I was this kid traveling to the Peace Hall at weekends in Halifax to a secondhand bookstore, buying the most pretentious books I could find, Nietzsche's Philosophizing with a Hammer and The Antichrist and Kundera. And as I said, I was introduced to Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Neruda, and my whole world was expanding because of the other foreign students that I was meeting. Katerina from Germany was introducing me to Brecht. And I just felt so spoilt and enriched. And I remember feeling, you know, how privileged I was to be able to look out a window that overlooked the moors sometimes in the snow, and it was so beautiful, and to be dancing to that music, and for those studios to be filled with so much imagination and hope held in that crepuscular lighting.
And we play some music now. You mentioned Silvio Rodriguez, and this is El Mayor.
Now, yeah. What,
and is this something you would have danced to?
Yeah. Again, Josie, she was such a visionary. She would select these artists. And in that moment, and not that any of us knew what he was singing about, I think, would create this little masterpiece that would just disappear at the end of a class.
Okay.
hombre se hizo siempre de todo material, de vías señoriales o barrio marginal. Toda época fue pieza de un rompecabezas para subir la cuesta.
And that was Silvio Rodriguez, Díaz y Flores, El Mayor, the choice of Lisa Doan, who's with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. So, Key Street, somebody said, you should be an actor. You went for a bunch of auditions. Just give me a potted history now of your TV career, because when people talk about, you know, you appearing in these Beckett productions and something, they forget that you were in things like Fair City, and you were in that Oliver Twist was a big one for you as well,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, Walt Disney film.
Yeah, that, what was that like actually? Because you know what, these that sort of Walt Disney film is not intended to change the world or anything, and yet it did for you in lots of ways.
Yeah, I think every little experience changes the world for you. I mean, I was picked from Galway, from Shakespeare. And at that time, when I was living in Galway, again, a very, very, very magical experience. I might have been living in a flat with black plastic bags over the windows, and I was, with about enough money to have a sausage roll and a pizza slice a day, and working in various cafes. But I remember, and this is just come back to me only a few days ago. I was walking down Key Street and there's Charlie Burns bookstore, and I come across a book by Patsy Rodenberg, An Actor Speaks. And I have it at home still, and I bought it for £3.50. And I remember taking it home to that little bedsit that I had with the black plastic bags on the windows on in Lower Saltail. And would sit there listening to Suzanne Vega and think, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if I was an actress, and hearing about places like the Old Vic and the National Theatre and Laurence Olivier, and reading this, and it was all coming into my mind. And I thought this woman sounded extraordinary, just about the relationship between an audience and an actor's voice. And that's when I started to dream about the possibility of being an actor. And then I was doing this one-woman show in the Old Vic 2 years ago, and Matthew Orca said, you know, it's a big old barn of a theatre. It's a 1,000-seater, you know, and it's just you up there. We'll get someone in to help you with your voice and prepare your voice. And I said, great. In walks Patsy Rodenberg. Wow. And she comes straight up to me and she puts her hands on my womb and she said, it's all there. We just need to root it. And she's become a major trap route for me in my life. And I can't believe she's this woman whose book I picked up in Charlie Burns is one of my key mentors today.
It's a brilliant story. It's even more brilliant how you sidestepped the wonderful world of Disney, which I put together.
I'll go back again. No, you can always, Disney's always there.
Disney's always there. And then, of course, what was that Bow Wow thing? Big Bow Wow.
There's Big Bow Wow.
And you were in that as well.
I was in that. But the most hilarious thing is I was cast out of Galway when I had all these romantic notions of playing Antigone and the Greeks and Shakespeare. And next thing I get cast in Mystic Knights of Tir na n'Og, where I was a warrior princess for 56 episodes.
I've seen the pictures. I haven't seen the picture, but I've seen the pictures.
And I'm wandering around. I only took a look at that mountain yesterday when I was out in Dalkey. The baby sugar loaf, running around the baby sugar loaf in -2 degrees in February in horizontal rain and a leotard and boots covered in clover and cattle excrement, shouting about Kells with a plastic crossbow that would later, under CGI 3 weeks later, shoot tornadoes. And I remember we had this hilarious stunt coordinator called Bronco. I hope he's still around, Bronco. But Bronco is shouting up at you as I'm dangling from a mountain with this rope wrapped around my chest, slicing my left breast off, I might add, as the wind was picking me up and banging me off the mountain. And Bronco didn't have a lot of teeth, and he would look up at me and say, I'm telling you, it's perfectly safe. I said, it's safe. I started myself, for Christ's sake, it's safe.
And here's the woman who danced with Nureyev. But, you know, you must have been getting a sort of proper professional head on you at that point. You were working.
I was working, and somehow, it's so funny, I only said this to my best friend Aidan yesterday. We were heading out for a walk in Dorking, and she looks nothing like me, and she said, "How did you manage to get me a job as your photo double? I mean, you couldn't see two people who looked totally different." But she was my body double, which meant I had a buddy on set, and I had a stunt double and a stand-in. But we worked so many hours. You needed all of that. I was so young, and I was doing 3 episodes every 12 days, and we're on set from 7 a.m. to, you know, well into the late hours.
I'm in the mood to watch Mystic Knights of Chernanog. That's what it was called, wasn't
it? Well, look, I learned so much. I learned everything from it. So sometimes people like to poke holes it and take the piss, and they're welcome.
No, but
it's hilarious.
I'm not.
And I remember I was a Happy Meal doll. My doll was sold in McDonald's. I was a Wellington boot. I was a SpaghettiO. I was brought out to America to open up a theme park in SeaWorld. And it was just hilarious. And myself, Vinny and Lachlan and all the lads. And we, you know, I was about a 40 a day smoker on this kind of kids show, rocking up with a fag hanging out of my mouth the entire time.
I think we should play Suzanne Vega at this point. This is important to you, because this is what Suzanne Vega is what you were listening to when you needed it.
There hasn't been a week in my life where Suzanne Vega hasn't featured. And I recently went to see her at the Carlisle Club in New York, and I brought my sister, and we sat front row, and I proceeded to sing every single lyric of hers up Suzanne's nose while the poor woman was trying to concentrate while her crazy super fan was in the front row. And my sister was so embarrassed, she just kept saying, "Stop it, stop it." Thankfully, I've met Suzanne since, and I must admit, I'm still a little starstruck. I find it very difficult to act normal around Suzanne Vega.
Suzanne Vega there, and a song called Cracking, the choice of Lisa Dwan, who's with me in studio tonight. Lisa's picking all the tunes, and we'll be right back after this break. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM until 9 o'clock Sunday night, the special excursion when we get someone to pick the music. And tonight it's the actress and academic and many other things, Lisa Dwan, who's with me in studio. We've been through some great tunes and great stories so far. We're going to stay in Galway for a moment. Galway seems to have been the place where everything sort of started to turn for you in a good way.
I think so. Yeah. I love Galway. Yeah. I really do. They used to call it the graveyard of ambition, but for me, it was such a fertile time of daydreaming, sitting in cafes, smoking, dreaming, writing thoughts. And maybe manifesting a lot of what's happened since. Looking back, I probably needed a better social life, but I used to commit an awful lot of poetry to memory then. And I remember thinking, God, wouldn't it be amazing if I got to do something like that for a living? Not knowing that that kind of living was actually possible. Mm. And somehow I've kind of made it possible.
What sort of poetry were you memorizing?
A lot of Eliot.
Yeah.
I committed all of The Wastelands and Prufrock to memory.
Just for fun, for crack
on a Friday night. Sure, why not?
Yeah, but it was just for yourself, and you probably never got to recite it for anybody or anything.
Not at that time, no. But I couldn't. Like, people would buy paintings. Well, why not? You know, take a poem and make your own. Yeah. It's cheaper.
Yeah.
And
had you any kind of literary training along the way? Because
because I dropped out of school.
Yeah,
no one was.
I don't mean to underestimate you, but T.S. Eliot is not easy. Do you know what I mean? It's not like learning off other poems, which you can learn rat-a-tat-tat-tat-tat, you know?
I had dinner with an old friend on Friday night, and she reminded me that when we were in school, I always had a book behind the maths book, that I was either reading Auden or Austen, or, you know, I guess I was just always that weird kid. And you know, I just adored poetry, and I have difficulty reading aloud, so I always feel a lot more confident committing things to memory. And I love having those trinkets, those treasures in my memory box.
And as you say, it's interesting that you know, this is something you thought, imagine being able to do this all the time. And then when you kind of came to a new sort of prominence, it was literally the fact that this incredible feat of memorizing Beckett and being able to deliver it, the most complex parts of Beckett that you could find. You
but
know?
Also to take something so revered and make it your own.
Mm.
And I think bit by bit, I'd been learning how to do that all along.
But even just to concentrate on the, you know, that to the outsider, what was obviously difficult about the Beckett thing that you were doing was that you could remember it all. Start. And I know it's not about remembering. When you perform, actors always say they're not on stage actively remembering the lines, they're already in them.
Well,
but at the same time, at some point you have to sit down and learn this thing.
And the dance discipline. Look, when I was doing Not I, I would time my head to the banisters and I would record myself doing it, and I would train my diaphragm and my body to be able to produce that sound at the speed of thought. And I trained my body to do that. And I trained my memory to do it. And I worked hard at it. Mm. And I don't know why, when actors in Hollywood are revered for gaining a few pounds or losing a few pounds or whatever they, you know, I mean, musicians aren't praised for practicing every day. So I don't understand why actors can't work at their craft every day.
Yeah.
And it was no skin off my nose. And I found it, you know, I'm always working.
Well, I saw that film of you walking around the kitchen making cups of tea, just constantly repeating the Beckett over and over and over again at lightning speed, you know. And then the physical side of being strapped to this thing.
Yeah.
I think, I suppose, if I see a musician playing something extraordinary on a saxophone, I can't do that. I know I can't do that. But when I see somebody speaking, basically speaking, I think, well, that's something we can all do, but not like that, not what you've done. You know, it's on a level that's kind of incomprehensible to most people.
I don't know if that's true.
Oh, it is.
I found it was possible because other braver soldiers went before me. Billy Whitelaw broke a psychological barrier by being able to do it in 14 minutes. It was almost like Roger Bannister's 4-minute mile.
Yeah.
And we've just had the 2-hour marathon being broke. You know, we all stand on each other's shoulders in this field, I think. And she made it possible. And also, more than anything else, gave me the permission to make it my own. And I think, to go back to your point about memorization, the only way memory is possible by personalizing it and making it your own and taking a purchase in it. I mean, Fiona Shaw inspired me with The Wastelands, that it could all come from a woman's body. Mm. And she opened up that door of possibility. As I said, these extraordinary women that I was so lucky to be exposed to didn't let geography or chewing gummed beer ruined floors get in the way of the Royal Ballet choreography happening on an Athlone stage. You know, I have been extremely lucky to have these women, these trailblazers, these visionaries open my eyes for me.
I want to talk about Billy Whitelaw specifically, but let's play one of the tracks from the Galway period. We're getting out of step here, but from back in Galway, Jeffrey Oryema, who's an artist who was on the Real World record label when we started listening to this thing called world music, as it was then being labelled and marketed.
Well, Galway was just full of dreadlocks and dogs on strings and whale's teeth and people doing djembes and...
Thank you.
That's called Macambo. It's from Jeffrey Oryema from an album which I remember coming out on the Real World label called Exile. That brings me back. I used to play it on the radio years ago.
Wow.
Beautiful song, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that was you in Galway. Now, let's talk about Billy Whitelaw. Obviously, you never got to work with Beckett. But the connection with Billy Whitelaw is very important in terms of that lineage, isn't it? Because she was his actress.
Well, she was one of his muse, yeah.
Yeah, very important to him. And then tell me how you met her and what she would have said to you.
So I moved to London when I was about 21 or something, or 22. I couldn't be taken seriously as an actor here on stage.
Why not?
I have no idea, and there's no point going back thinking about that. But I could never get an audition in the Gate or the Abbey or anything. And I still, despite, you know, the TV and stuff, and maybe I was a bit pretentious and not grateful enough, but I had all these romantic notions about theatre and the Greeks. And I was part of that whole kind of Beckett gathering they had here. I was doing a TV series with Stephen Brennan, who's a great Beckett actor, and I'll never forget we were on our way out to set, and the car stopped at Beckett Street Bridge, and he describes in detail in Not I, this one woman play, how a disembodied mouth is hovering 8 foot above the stage, and even though the actor's head is locked into something rigid, that in an entirely blackened out auditorium, that the mouth appears to roam or osculate throughout the theatre. And even though I still to this day have never seen a version of Not I on stage, all I have is the image that Stephen Brennan painted in my imagination in 2000 on Baggot Street Bridge. And I was around during the time that they were committing all of Beckett's work to film as part of this project. And that became my bar and my benchmark when I thought about theatre. And I couldn't get a purchase in for whatever reasons, but I moved to London then. And I still to this day don't know if it was a mistake, but somebody sent me the script of Not I with a time and audition for the next day. And my first impulse when I read the script was, oh, Jesus, Beckett, I'm going to have to call my intelligent brother to help unpack this with a big giant mental pickaxe for me. And I couldn't reach him. And so with the pressure mounting for the audition the next day, I just sat down alone and read, and there I was. It was my mind splayed open on a page. I saw waves of corrections and interruptions. I heard the nuns no sooner buttoned up his breeches, the parochial acerbic asides at home, my mother's tender mercies and God is love. And I heard home, and it seemed to be written with a kind of rhythm that was propelling me along to speak it quite fast. Mm. There was three dots, then two dots, then three dots and a dot dash. And I could see how it wasn't just a neat stream of consciousness reminiscent of Joyce or Eliot, that this was more chaotic than that. It was more of a cacophony. It was more pressured. And I got the part the next day. And the director's only note was Beckett wanted this spoken at the speed of thought because he wanted it to play on the nerves of the audience and not the intellect.
Right.
And I remember I would practice and rehearse and try to avoid any mention of the word Billy Whitelaw, who I knew was synonymous with this role. But I knew that if I let her shadow into my work, I would be too intimidated. Or worse, I would try and copy what she was doing and therefore wouldn't find my own access point. And the other instinct, and I'm getting a little bit better at listening to my instincts, but my instinct then was that this had to be my own.
Mm. And how can you do that with Beckett when he famously leaves very clear instructions as to how something has to be done?
Oh, there's loads of scope within his seemingly rigid lines. There's plenty of scope to dance his language. Mm. And the only way to do it is to make it your own, because otherwise you're going to be sentimental. And Beckett has shown me time and time again that sentimentality is the language of gangsters. And there's only one way of performing Beckett, and that's ripping your skin off. And you do it disciplined within his lean lines, and you don't allow space for excess or force. You know, it has to be contained. And that ability of having your body strapped to this board that I stand in, my head in a head harness, means that your imagination is utterly liberated. You can leave your body, and you can leave your relationship with your own body and the politics of your body and other people's aspersions on your body. And as a young woman, to be liberated from your body, I can tell you there's nothing as gorgeous as that feeling. I would say that Beckett introduced me to myself. And I remember training myself in my memory, putting on a blindfold, and my director would take me out to a park, and I would feel the grass just to have some sort of sensory connections to bolster my memory in this piece, because you're just alone and it's written in such a tricksy, fragmented, repetitive way that you need something. So that time when it gets to or that time she cried, the one time she could remember since she was a baby, must have cried as a baby, perhaps not central to life, just the birth cry to get her, that I would reach for the grass in Croker's Acres, home, a little mound in Croker's Acres, that I would reach for the grass and various different little things like that.
It's still within you, is it? It's still there?
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
And I remember one time I did it, and I did a whole run of the monologue, and I took off my eye mask, and I had collected an audience of park bench drunks who stood there gripping their cans of cider, and we just looked at each other in complete acknowledgement, and they were using that cider to quieten that internal voice, and there was just this look of complete recognition.
Beckett would have loved that, wouldn't he?
He would, and you realise that he did want it to bypass the intellect, because there is something that's communicated on a completely other level. And Beckett touched on that in theatre. He created a whole new space in theatre. And that was a space that was as close to poetry and dance as I had ever known. It wasn't rigid in its narrative, as Beckett says in Text for Nothing. No need of a story. Life alone is enough. And that's what I adored about Beckett, is that we are liberated from stories about ourselves and these manipulative, sentimental narratives that keep us in check. They're used so cleverly by the Greeks and onwards to control the logos and ideas of ourselves. And Beckett blows all of that up and offers us the most unrelenting, at times a frightening look at ourselves, but it's stark and brilliant and vast. And I remember a friend of mine said to me, you know, Beckett's a very cruel writer. It might be okay for him to describe the universe in that way, but the rest of us need our delusions. Mm. And in many ways, she's right. It's hard to eyeball our own loneliness, our own impending death that we're all just a breath away from.
And what did you feel like physically afterwards?
Spent.
Yeah. Exhausted.
Yeah, absolutely spent.
Fit for nothing? I mean, could you walk home? I mean, were you in bits?
No, I was always, you know, one of the great things, and I would advise, and I could have set riots here in the theatre world, but I would advise more actors to produce their own work. You'd realise how liberating it actually is. When you have to keep one eye on box office and one eye on marketing and one eye on your crew, and even though maybe I bit off more than I could chew, who knows, it means you don't have the luxury of going mad. Mm. I don't have a safety net to allow myself go crazy. So I think I push my body often at times quite severely, but I'm not crazy. I have no interest in money. But I'm not interested in being a star. I'm interested in the thing being the best possible thing I can make it. And in my case, having been spoiled rotten in the most expansive, spoiling, luxurious way in many respects. It was intellectually spoiling and luxurious. Beckett's landscape, constantly fertile. Anytime you dig in Beckett's work, you'll always find something. And you'll just always find a nod back to Dante or Virgil or the Bible, you know, but there's always something underneath to stand on. And that's a tremendous privilege.
Just before we leave that, I asked you about Billy Whitelaw.
Oh, yeah, and I took you, of course.
No, not that. I just want to, when you encountered Billy Whitelaw, what happened then?
Oh, it was amazing. So I managed to get through the first performance without meeting her. And then Edward Beckett came along to my first performance. Says, Jesus, you should really meet Billy now that you've found your own way. And he introduced us. And we did this documentary together for The Verb. And turns out she just lived 100 yards from my house all the time. I didn't know while I was tying my head into the banister. She was quite a recluse at this stage, living on Parliament Hill, and we greeted each other like two long-lost war veterans. She'd never met anyone who'd played, not I, and neither had I. And we shared all of our stories from the trench. And how did you swallow? And did you feel like a pelican? Yeah. And she remembered every word of it. And a year after we met, she called me up out of the blue and she said, can you come round, please? I want to give you his notes. I have to give you his notes. And I thought she might take out an old rehearsal manuscript with his scrawly writing on it that we've all become familiar with. And I didn't really know what had me in her kitchen that afternoon, but apart from tremendous respect for her and their relationship. And when I came in, she said, sit down. And I did. And she said, begin. And I said, what? And she said, I know you haven't forgotten it. And I did. Out into this world, tiny little thing before it's time and a God for what? And she was sat opposite her kitchen table, conducting me. Ta-ta-ta-ta, ta-ta-ta-ta. But the brain, when there's alliteration, punch the bees. And I realised that's what Beckett had done to her across her kitchen table. And she unlocked lots of technical aids she used, but not once did she ever try and force feed me a Beckettian style of acting. She was very conscious that she didn't want to put that on me. She wanted to give me the keys to access my own Beckett. And she kept saying, you know, I was putting a kind of fake monotone on it because that's how I thought Beckett was supposed to be spoken. And she said, what are you doing? No, bring all that in. It has to come from you. And I realized then that in the years that followed, it was never about the speed. It was the sound and the sense of our edge that he was after. He wanted to hear what our edge sounded like.
I'm thinking ahead now to Nose Knife, which you did in the Abbey. I saw you there. And it was a big event, you know. but were you... Do you seriously still have that sense that, you know, who does she think she is putting on Beckett plays and stuff? You know what you were saying, you know, there's
If I'm not thinking it, someone would be very quick to remind me.
Yeah, but there's always somebody like that.
There is, but there's a lot of them. And when you're what I love about Beckett is that he's put the mind on stage. Mm-hmm. And the chorus, the committee of critics that live in our heads. But I've had to, in the past, I would have drunk my way through it, and I don't resort to those antics anymore.
You couldn't possibly, you know, if you're
drunk. I used to. My first time when I was performing, not I. I was having a few brandies backstage.
But does that not, you know?
I had to.
But can you perform?
No, you can't. And, you know, I quit drinking very long time ago now. But it does mean that you just have to kind of find other ways of transcending those voices. And one of those is this fabulous stage manager I've worked with many, many times for years. Her name is Yvonne. But she's a big Nick Cave fan.
Yeah.
And she has a tattoo of his face on her leg. And next thing, an usher on opening night. And it's so funny because I was listening to this. Hang on now. I was listening to this album in order to gain strength for getting up on stage. I would listen to it running on the heath, and just that refrain, you know, regardless about how I'm feeling, this is what she's born to do. This is who she is and what she does. This is just what I do. And I have to do it regardless how I'm feeling about it. But this usher came up and said, Nick Cave is in the audience. And next thing, Siobhan hit the floor. It was the first time I'd ever seen Siobhan cave. And I said to her, get up now. And started roaring at her. And afterwards, I said to her, Siobhan, we make work that Nick Cave comes to.
Upside down and inside out and on a leash, like a funnel web, like a black fly on the ceiling. Skinny white haunches high and skyward, and a black oily gash crawling backwards across the carpet.
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds and Rings of Saturn. Lisa, I think I read somewhere, maybe it was that film I saw, that you used to listen to Nick Cave before performances. One performance in particular, is that?
This was the one.
Yeah. And that was the song, was it?
Yeah. Wow. This was the song. And then he turned out to be in the audience. Summoned.
No pressure. That thing, you know, thinking about Nick Cave, you know, who for so long, his whole demeanour was of, you know, darkness, you know, and then real darkness really visited him, you know. Do you know what I mean? It became kind of real.
And what's just extraordinary about him is that he just leant into that, yeah, and transformed those wounds into these extraordinary offerings. And that's the kind of principle I try to follow.
Well, you've mentioned the Black Dog a couple of times tonight. Yeah. And you know, how does that affect the work? Do you know what I mean? Does the work help, or does it make the work impossible? Do you know?
It depends on the circumstances. Mm. I've always found, and I'm very lucky, you know, I have a colossal propensity for joy, and we kind of began with that. And it's, I must try and remember when I'm in the jowls of Black Dog, how close that propensity is, and not to quit before that dawn. And I'm also extremely fortunate. I have an extraordinary amount of friends around me. My life has led me into places and into people that my work mightn't be for everybody, but it touches other people. And that's why people like Colm have given up a year of their lives and written a play for me. And I'm now working with Margaret Atwood.
What are you doing with Margaret Atwood?
She rang me up and she said, why are you doing Antigone? And I said, well, you know why I'm doing Antigone. It's one woman narrative taking on the patriarchy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But why aren't you doing Medea? You should be doing Medea. And I said, why? And she said, well, think about it. And I said, well, I'm thinking about it. And I was drawing a blank and she said, you've got that funny little accent and everyone hates you. You're perfect. And so I said, well, fucking write me one then. We've begun working on a one-woman Medea that is being directed by Robert Lepage.
Wow.
And
Will you come on next week and pretend to be Margaret Atwood? That'd be a good show. We'd get away with it. But you know, all I'm wondering is, in terms of the Black Dog, does it mean that do you, in those circumstances, need to throw yourself into the work, or are you just not fit to work? You don't want to work. You don't want to know about work.
No, I always work. It's never got to a stage, thank God, where apart from maybe when I was drinking and I was no use to anybody. But to accept that I have tumultuous weather is kind of part of my personality, my psyche.
Because I wish people could have seen you at the top of the programme when Maria McCabe was on. I mean, you were dancing full on.
And I will be again, were you to stick it on. You know, I do know that that propensity is always there, and you just have to remind yourself in moments when you're in the jowls that that is available to me also, that the two can coexist.
In the context of the next song that you have chosen, though,
Is
it a good idea? Is it a good idea to go into music which is dark? Or should you avoid music that is dark? I mean, we're drawn to Nick Cave songs. We're drawn to what's coming up next.
And I'm drawn to darkness.
Yeah.
And I find a lot of solace and truth in that. I think if I've any kind of barometer in life, it's truth. And I try and listen to the timbre of it in people's voices or in their work or in the reminiscences that they've left behind, like Beckett. And I hate being dictated to. I hate a polemic. I've worked in PR. I know the shtick. And again, I'm not really interested in people's stories. I'm interested in their souls. And I find what's extraordinary about somebody like Nick Cave or Beckett is that they have managed to transform those wounds and give them to us as offerings. And I, in turn, have learned how to make my wounds work. And in many respects, it's really helped me make sense of my life. Oh, that's why that happened. Oh, look, I can give it a job. I can cast it as, you know, this sentence in this particular monologue. Or I can think about it at this moment while it rips my skin off and close it up again. And I've been able to wrap my own wounds around my work and make them into richer, more textured things.
And there's Bonnie Prince, Billy, I See a Darkness, the choice of Lisa Dwan, who's with me in studio. Lisa, the idea of collaborating with other people and, you know, well, I'm leading up to a happy collaboration with Thomas, I don't know what you're laughing at, a happy collaboration with Thomas Bartlett here, you know.
Oh, yeah.
From another discipline in one way, you know, well, in obvious ways, a musician, but how does something like that come about? How do you guys find each other?
Actually, this is a hilarious story. Irla
O'Leonard. If you do it in the voice of Margaret Atwood. No, go on.
Irla O'Leonard thought it'd be a great idea to try and set Thomas Bartlett and I up on a date. And for anyone who knows either of us knows that that's just the worst idea on earth. And anyway, we found ourselves in a restaurant together and it was just so inappropriate on a whole range of levels. I think Thomas was about three bottles in and we hadn't even had a starter, and I don't think we even bothered ordering a main course. And we said, well, thanks a million. Lovely to meet you. And then he's a gentleman, so he gets me into a taxi. I said, do you need a lift? And he said, no, I'll get the subway. And then I actually see him coming back out of the subway to go back into the restaurant. And I was so embarrassed. I come to New York months later with my Becketts, and I get this ecstatic phone call from him. And could I please come for dinner? Could he take me for dinner? Could I meet his mom? And invited me up to, they have this Sunday dinner now, which I've become part of the Bartlett family that he invited me to. And it's just the most extraordinary thing. You could have anyone from Mandy Patinkin there to Nico Muli to, you know, it's It's a bizarre gathering of New York orphans. And while we're there, he said, we should work on something together. And I said, well, actually, I'm starting to work on Text for Nothing and I need to record it. And Beckett writes like music. And in fact, I showed him the very first draft of Footfalls, which is exactly like a Stave of Music. And I said, I am trying to work out the various pitches of voices on this score, which, you know, is just a prose piece that I was transforming into a score for the stage. And I didn't know whether to do recorded voice and some. So it was a lot of work. So we collaborated on Text for Nothing and we would sit in a studio together and we wouldn't speak. And he had his back to me. And I've shared this with many people like Julia Stone and Annie Clark or Annie St. Vincent. And they all have the same experience. There's an extraordinary intelligence, gift, whatever you call it, of Thomas Bartlett's, that he's able to sit in your mind and almost preempt decisions you're about to make. Not that one, that one. And I've never kind of shared that space, that mental space with somebody else so intimately as I have with that man. And even though, you know, we're so different in so many ways, when you sit in a studio with somebody like him, it is a phenomenal experience. He is so sensitive. And you really share one of the loneliest places on earth with somebody else. And they just sit there hovering like a kind of diffident guest, but deeply appreciative and sensitive. And the impact is very powerful. And I kept saying to him, you know, God, Thomas, you're great. And he said, yeah, some people say you're tricky. He said, I find you amazing to work with. And I said, well, you've got a lot of help.
What are we going to hear?
But while we were working together, he created this piece. And you would sit in Thomas's studio till about 3 a.m. And I think the refrain is something probably deep at the heart of maybe what drives us.
Now, nobody has heard this. And Thomas, yeah. Thomas has given us the all clear to play it. So this is called In the End. In the End, gorgeous piece. And thanks to Thomas for letting us play that, because nobody's heard that before, Lisa. And no. thanks for the introduction on that one. Before you go, this play, which is opening on Thursday, Lisa, written for you by Colm Tobin. What's it called? What's it based on?
So it's called Pale Sister. It's a retelling of the Antigone myth told from the point of view of Ismene. It comes out of a project. Colm came to me when he saw me in Nose Knife and said, I'd like to write you a play. I said, I need an Antigone. This was me recovering from the heat of 2016 and issues around narrative and wondering, what am I going to do? How do I respond to this? I'm not much of a joiner, so being part of the hashtag movement wasn't really me. I guess I don't trust any kind of movements, but I was very interested in wondering, could we go any deeper? And I really started to think about narratives that can receive things like Nasty Woman or Tricky Woman, or, you know, that.
Do you really think you're an
that you're, no, well, you well think, I'm you, just I'm just very interested how they work, and they do work. These narratives we constrict us. And I was thinking about that in the world of misogyny. When I went to hear Brian Stevenson talk of the Equal Justice Initiative in America, who set up a museum on lynching, and he spoke about America will never be able to pull itself out of the jaws of racism until she confronts her narratives. And I thought about that in terms of misogyny. And he was saying that the South may have lost, or the North may have won the war, but the South won the narrative. And I was thinking about narratives and how, having been liberated from narratives for so long in Beckett's work, that when I go back to play Pinter's whore and virtuous wife, when I play the shrill girlfriend who goes from naught to crazy in a mere nanosecond with the greatest economy of words in Conor McPherson's Shining City, you know, that these caricatures of women that we're constantly being asked to perpetuate and keep alive and resurrect that just don't reflect anything I know. I thought, let's go back and examine this. And to go back to that, you go back to the Greeks and the early roots. And, you know, the Greeks were super smart. They were building a democracy, and at the same time, they were controlling the logos. All citizens were forced to go. They were paid to go to the theatre. And I say citizens, I'm only talking about the men. And through these narratives, these pulpits, they learned how to deal with an upstart woman, a shrill young upstart woman, the Greta Thunbergs, the Nancy Pelosi's, the Hillary Clintons, you know, and they're all crazy. It's funny, isn't it? And then they learn how to deal with the immigrant mother in Medea, or that untrustworthy beauty in Helen of Troy, or intelligence in Medusa, just cut off her head. So I wanted to go back and put some flesh on these characters, making it more difficult for the next generation. I thought about my, you know, if I'm going to contribute anything to theatre, and this is probably just a complete drop in the ocean to imagine it'll be any bigger than this is ridiculous and probably very vain of me, but I have to try. And I just wanted my nieces to be able to see a different Antigone. And every single version I've read, and we studied and worked at this in Columbia, Colm and I, we examined and re-examined every Antigone that's been left, from Tom Poland to Antigonic by Anne Carson, by Brecht to Ennui to Heaney. And Rudolf Steiner says, you know, Antigones are being imagined and reimagined for hundreds of years with the same implicit message: Antigone, lie down. And I don't want that to happen. I don't want to lie down.
That opens Thursday night at the Gate. And I hope that goes really well for you. There's, you know, something, there's so much more to talk about. We never even got into the whole academic side of your life. Many places are you professor now? Professor of what, where? I mean, it's all over the place, isn't it?
I don't know.
You don't even know
yourself.
Travelling
circus. Yeah. I teach a lot in America.
Princeton
and Columbia. And this year I'm at MIT in Georgetown. And I've been lucky.
Tell you. Listen, I'm so grateful for you for coming in, Lisa. I know you're busy. And I hope it goes all well on Thursday night and for the run. Thanks to Anya Faye, my producer. And Lisa, thanks a million for coming and picking all these tunes.
Thank
real pleasure.
You so much for having me on this train.
Your last track, Sinead?
Yeah, well, when Colm came to see me perform in Washington and he sent me the first draft he'd written of this Pale Sister, the first question I had for him was, Colm, what do you think about Antigone? He went, well, I suppose she's a bit like Sinead O'Connor.
Lisa, thanks a million.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.